Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine, the April 2022 edition. The stories that I'll be reading today feature various states and take us on a travel across the Old West. Wyoming's Colorful Characters by Candy Moulton. Hit the road where the famous roamed across the cowboy state. Buffalo, end of the trail for Johnson County invaders. When the Johnson County invasion force, comprised of Texas cowboys and Wyoming cattlemen, rode north from Casper in 1892, they intended to wipe out the men they had labeled as cattle rustlers. At the KC Ranch, they encountered Nate Champion, Nick Ray, Ben Jones, and Bill Walker. Having no quarrel with Walker and Jones, the cattlemen allowed the two to leave the ranch house unharmed. But they surrounded the cabin sheltering Champion and Ray and ultimately killed both. Their interlude at the KC changed the course of their plans, however, when other area residents saw the attack there and spread the word to Buffalo. Upon departing the KC, the invasion force continued north, with the intended target of men on a dead list and the town of Buffalo. They got as far as the TA Ranch, about 14 miles from Buffalo, when a group of county residents who had organized at Buffalo, upon learning of the advancing invaders, forced another siege. This time, the invaders were surrounded and fighting for their lives. They negotiated their way into a surrender after successfully getting a message to Governor Amos Barber about their plight. The governor, with support from the state's two senators, informed President Benjamin Harrison of the situation in Johnson County, and he ordered federal troops from Fort McKinney, located near Buffalo, to take command of the situation. The invaders were taken into custody, but never prosecuted. Learn more about the Johnson County invasion, as well as the Indian battles that took place in the region, at the Jim Gatchell Museum in Buffalo, or during a visit to Fort Phil Kearny State Historic Site. By traveling north of Buffalo, visitors can also see the locations where the December 21, 1866 Fetterman fight and the Wagon Box fight of August 2, 1867 took place. The Occidental Hotel served visitors to Buffalo in the period of the Johnson County invasion, and it still does today, though the building and the beds have been greatly improved. Cheyenne, Frontier Crossroads for the Like of Hickok, Horn, and Calamity Jane. Born in Missouri in 1856, Martha Canary came west with her family, spent part of her childhood in the Montana goldfields near Virginia City and Nevada City, came of age, most likely, in Utah, before working her way east to Cheyenne. Along the way, she picked up the name Calamity Jane. Started as an end-of-tracks town by the Union Pacific Railroad, Cheyenne was the territorial capital of Wyoming by the time Calamity arrived in the early 1870s. This city, established when the Union Pacific Railroad pushed through in 1867, became a hub for people headed into Wyoming. And many now famous folks were there in addition to Calamity, including Wild Bill Hickok, Bat Masterson, Doc Holliday, and Tom Horn. While Calamity, Hickok, Masterson, and Holliday spent limited time in the city, Tom Horn was there often, as it was part of his regular stomping ground during his years as a range detective. Horn spent time drinking in Cheyenne and made his famous confession for the killing of Willie Nickel in the Inter-Ocean Hotel in downtown Cheyenne. Not only that, but he was held in the local jail prior to his hanging in Cheyenne on November 20th, 1903. Cheyenne's downtown is wonderfully preserved, with many of the buildings from the end of Horn's era still in use. The Cheyenne Railroad Depot anchors the area and includes a visitor information center, as well as a railroad museum. Also in the downtown area is the Nelson Museum, with its impressive, eclectic collection of Old West gear and Indian memorabilia, and the Small Cowgirl of the West Museum. For history and artifacts, visit the Cheyenne Frontier Days Old West Museum and Messenger's Old West Museum. Cody, the showman's town, remains a showplace. William F. Cody recruited performers for his Wild West show in Sheridan, but he left his name on a town west of the Bighorn Mountains, where his legacy is on display at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West. In the center's Buffalo Bill Museum, vintage film shows Cody in his Wild West performance days, and there are personal family items on display. Down the street is the Irma Hotel, named for his daughter, where you can still have a drink at the bar he brought to the community. Other attractions at the center of the West include the Cody Firearms Museum, Plains Indian Museum, Whitney Western Art Museum, Draper Wildlife Museum, and McCracken Research Library. Cody is a good place to explore frontier history at Old Trail Town, a collection of authentic buildings gathered from across the region. Unlike the spit and polish of the center of the West, Old Trail Town is rough and tumble, and just about as real as it gets if you want to see and touch history. At the Cody Firearms Experience, shoot replica weapons ranging from a 1795 Springfield flintlock and an 1862 Gatling gun to an 1851 Colt Navy or a Buntline Special, and dozens of others. Get ready for rodeo every night during the summer, or at the Cody Stampede July 1st through the 4th, or plan to attend the Winchester Arms Collections Association annual show July 8th through the 10th. Cody is also the eastern gateway to Yellowstone National Park, which celebrates its sesquicentennial this year. Not far down the highway is the Matisse Museum, where visitors learn more about the ranching community. The museum has a summer speakers series, plans a tour of the historic ranches of Matisse, and a program on how the archaeological record can give insight into landscape use. Casey, gateway to Hole in the Wall. Named for the Casey Ranch, this small town is a gateway to Hole in the Wall country, where the Wild Bunch that included Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid, Flat-Nosed George Curry, Elsie Lay, and dozens of others regularly gathered and hid out. Still remote and exhibiting much of the wild nature Butch and Sundance saw, Hole in the Wall is a good place to get a sense of the country they loved. Hoof Prints of the Past Museum not only has displays about local history and local outlaws, but it also hosts an annual tour, this year planned for June 4th, that incorporates the KC fight site from the 1892 Johnson County invasion, where Nate Champion was killed, along with Hole in the Wall Valley. Champion was first ambushed at the Hall Cabin, which will be seen from an overlook during the tour. The tour also visits the homestead of Alex Gent and the Hole in the Wall site itself. Seeing the long red wall and a landscape little changed from what Butch and Sundance rode through it is reason enough to take this tour. But the museum also provides breakfast and lunch, along with history experts to share details from events in the area. Laramie, Gem City of the Plains, where Butch Cassidy was behind bars. The only time Butch Cassidy was jailed was at the Wyoming Territorial Prison in Laramie, where he spent 2 years. He was reportedly a model prisoner as he served his sentence for horse theft. The prison, which served as the University of Wyoming's livestock farm headquarters for many years, has been restored and operates as a state historic site. Besides seeing the original prison jail cells, you'll find a collection of historic and contemporary buildings representative of the area history and exhibits in the old horse barn from the stock farm days. The prison was in use from 1872 until 1903. Initially, it served as a federal prison, but became the state penitentiary when Wyoming achieved statehood in 1890. Cassidy, Robert Leroy Parker, was convicted and put in the prison in 1894 by Lander Judge Jesse Knight for buying a stolen horse from Billy Nutcher. After serving about 18 months, Cassidy was released early and then pardoned by Governor William Richards because the judge informed the governor that he had failed to disclose to the jury that in Wyoming, the purchase of stolen goods was a crime only if the person buying the goods knew they were stolen. Knight said that it was unclear whether Cassidy knew the horse he bought was a stolen animal. When Cassidy was released from prison, he was no doubt told to keep his nose out of trouble. But clearly, that stint behind bars didn't keep Cassidy on the straight and narrow. Within a short time, he was involved in outlaw activities. He had learned one thing, though, and that was how to elude law enforcers. He never again went to jail or prison. In addition to the territorial prison, Laramie has a variety of other sites worth a visit, including the Laramie Plains Museum at the historic Ivinson Mansion and Wyoming's Women's History House. Midway between Laramie and Cheyenne, visit the Ames Monument, which recognizes the construction of the Union Pacific Railroad, which gave both cities their start. Sundance, the town that gave an outlaw his name. Harry Alonzo Longabaugh left his Pennsylvania home while he was still in his teens to travel with a cousin to Durango and Cortez, Colorado, where they found work on ranches. Longabaugh then drifted north to work on the NN Ranch near Culbertson, Montana. But on February 27, 1887, when out of work, his life took a twist. Longabaugh stole a horse, a gun, and a saddle from an employee of the VVV Ranch near Sundance, Wyoming. He was arrested in Miles City, Montana, pleaded guilty on August 5, 1887, and spent 18 months in the Sundance Town Jail until pardoned by Wyoming Governor Thomas Moonlight on February 4, 1889. From this, he earned the name the Sundance Kid. Learn more about Longabaugh's time in the town that gave him his better-known name with a visit to the Crook County Museum. Nearby are two other sites well worth a visit. The Vor Buffalo Jump, adjacent to I-90 east of Sundance, is a rich bone bed that is the remnant of ancient hunting practices of American Indians. Another site, sacred to local tribes, is the geologic wonder of Devil's Tower, located north of Sundance near Hewlett. Hiking trails lead around the tower's base and through the adjacent wooded landscape. Wide Spot in the Road, Wyoming. Sometimes history comes full circle. That is the case with the collection of Plains Indian artifacts once owned by Golet and Edith Gallatin, who arrived in Bighorn in 1910. They welcomed visits from nearby Crow Indians and in return were given tribal items ranging from war bonnets to pipes and pipe bags and women's clothing. Ultimately, they had an extensive and important collection of Plains Indian gear, clothing, and material culture. For a time, these items were on display at the Chicago Art Institute, but they were returned to Bighorn and the region where they were first made, worn, used, and appreciated. They are now among the featured exhibits at the Forrest E. Mars Jr. Building at the Brenton Museum. Other Plains Indian artifacts on display are from the collection of Bradford Brenton, who purchased the Quarter Circle A Ranch in 1923. The Brenton Ranch House, also a part of the museum, features the original artwork of Hans Kleber, Bill Golings, Edward Burian, John James Audubon, and Frank Tenney Johnson, among others. Candy Moulton is the author of roadside history of Wyoming. Texas's Quanah Parker Trail by Mike Cox, True West Magazine, April 2022. Discover the life of the legendary Comanche following the arrows in the Lone Star State. Quanah Parker, war chief of the last band of free-roaming Quahati Comanches, faced the biggest battle of his life. But on this spring day in 1875, the fight would not be with the hated blue-coated horse soldiers. It was with himself. The son of Chief Peta Nakona and Cynthia Ann Parker, a white captive who adapted to Comanche ways only to be rescued by Texas Rangers in 1860 and forcibly returned to her birth family, Quanah had risen from young warrior to savvy war chief. He had been fighting for years to retain his people's way of life on the huge expanse known as the Llano Estacado, or Staked Plains. Only a year before, in the heart of Comancheria, commercial buffalo hunters had established a trading post called Adobe Walls in present-day Hutchinson County, Texas, their primary food source rapidly being decimated by the hide hunters. Hundreds of Comanches and Kiowas led by Quanah attacked the enclave in June 1874. The hunters, seasoned marksmen, held off the Indians, even though the defenders stood badly outnumbered. The Adobe Walls attack triggered the Red River War, the U.S. Army's 1874-75 campaign, to force Quanah and his people to the Comanche Kiowa Reservation at Fort Sill in western Oklahoma. In a score of engagements or skirmishes, Quanah and his warriors fought hard, using well-honed guerrilla tactics to stave off a 3,000-man military force bent on their subjugation. But the Comanches, once considered all but invincible, were not going to prevail. In early May 1875, with three Indian guides to help him find Quanah, Fort Sill Post surgeon and interpreter Dr. Jacob J. Sturm was sent to deliver an ultimatum from Colonel Ranald S. McKenzie: surrender or face annihilation. With roughly 100 warriors, Quanah was prepared to fight to the death, but he had the well-being of his people to consider. Was it time to take the white man's road? The matter, heavy on his mind and heart, Quanah rode alone from his band's hidden camp in what is now Borden County, Texas, to Mushaway Peak, a landmark rising nearly 400 feet above the surrounding plains. With a buffalo robe draped over his head, the chief stood on the high ground, pondering a decision that would have momentous consequences either way. As he took in the rugged landscape, he noticed a wolf in the distance. The animal raised its head and howled, then loped away to the northeast in the direction of Fort Sill and the reservation. Then Quanah saw an eagle circling overhead. With a flap of its wide wings, the raptor banked toward the northeast as well. Clearly, the chief concluded, the Great Spirit was telling him the day had come to quit fighting and lead his people to a new life of assimilation. In early June, the Cahade left Texas to settle on the reservation. The unfettered freedom they had enjoyed for generations had come to an end. Quanah Parker Trail. 139 years later, a group of Borden County residents, historians, tourism officials, volunteers, and Comanche tribal members stood in view of the peak in Gale, Texas, as workers embedded a 22-foot, 700-pound steel arrow in wet concrete. The arrow, one of 88 similar metal sculptures across the 52-county Texas Plains region, marking sites related to the war chief and his people, sticks from the ground adjacent to the Borden County Museum at US 180 at Farm to Market Road 669. The unique outdoor sculptures serve as waypoints along the Quanah Parker Trail, an expansive scattering of sites tied by history or legend to the clash of cultures that took place in the 1860s and 1870s on the Texas Plains. But unlike most trails, the QPT, as it's called, has no designated starting or ending place. Rather, as South Plains writer, historian, newspaper editor Dr. Barbara Brannon puts it, it is a conceptual trail. Something else makes the QPT different. Don't expect to find a brochure or web page with detailed directions to each arrow location. That said, most of the arrows are in plain sight, in parks, courthouse squares, and outside museums, but some protrude from private property. As the QPT website, QuanahParkerTrail.com, puts it, the Quanah Parker Trail wouldn't be much of an adventure if you could find everything with just a mouse click or screen tap, so take the challenge. In Comanche cosmology, the Great Spirit gathered swirls of dust from the four cardinal directions to create the Nirmerana, as they call themselves. Formed from the earth, the Comanche people have the strength of the strongest storm. One aspect of the QPT's creation story connects in a quirky but fitting way with one of the Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's classic poems, The Arrow and the Song, and its oft-quoted first verse, "I shot an arrow into the air, it fell to earth, I knew not where." Gid Moore, a Linn County farmer and insurance agent, envisioned for his small town of New Home, Texas, a children's park devoted to the great poets. With the famous line from Longfellow in mind, Moore commissioned New Home cotton farmer and longtime metal worker Charles A. Smith to build a large metal arrow that, when you put in place, would look as if it, too, had been shot into the air and fallen to earth. When Smith completed the sculpture, Moore placed it on a piece of property he owned in town. The park Moore envisioned did not materialize, but in 2010, another, more ambitious, public-oriented project was beginning to take shape on the northwest Texas plains. The impetus for the QPT developed along an axis extending as straight as a Comanche war lance from Quanah, Texas, named in honor of the chief, through the Crosby County community of Rawls to Lubbock. In 2004, then Rawls city manager J. Rhett Parker, a distant Parker relative who grew up hearing stories about the famous chief, suggested to Quanah's mayor that developing a trail devoted to Quanah Parker-related sites would be a worthy heritage tourism project. The idea lay dormant until 2009, when Quanah's Main Street program director, Hannibal Munn Welch, drew inspiration from a traveling exhibit on Quanah's life she saw in Arlington. She arranged for the exhibit to go on display at the Hardman County Historical Museum in Quanah, and went to work on the trail project. With input from then-Texas Plains Trail Coordinator Deborah Sue McDonald, Welch designed a Quanah Parker Trail website in 2010. Later that year, the trail concept developed further at a meeting involving Welch, McDonald, Three Rivers Foundation Arts Director Carolyn Wilson, and other Quanah civic leaders and Parker family representatives. On the Lubbock end of the imaginary feather-draped spear, educator and artist Dr. Hull Humphreys and Dr. Ty Creedler, executive director of the West Texas Historical Association, got involved in the effort early on. Humphreys is now the QPT facilitator and also serves on the nonprofit Quanah Parker Trail Steering Committee. The Arrow Trail. As the QPT began to take shape, the grassroots coalition realized they needed a fitting symbol to distinguish the proposed trail from other heritage tourism initiatives. Suggestions ranged from a Comanche shield to an eagle feather. but none seemed quite right. And then one day in January 2010, with McDonald behind the wheel and Dr. Humphreys riding shotgun, as they drove through New Home on their way to Lubbock, Humphreys saw a giant arrow sticking in the ground in the middle of a vacant field. She asked McDonald to turn around, and they went back for a closer look. As they approached the striking sculpture, the wind blowing through the long arrow's steel rod flanges made a gentle musical sound. No signage explained the purpose of the art piece or who owned it. Struck by the attention-getting arrow, Humphreys called the nearby high school, hoping to learn who had put it up. The first person she talked with said the arrow was the creation of Charles Smith and gave Humphreys his phone number. When Humphreys talked to Smith, he readily agreed to make more of his singing arrows at no cost, as long as Parker's descendants and the Comanche Nation were on board with the program, which they were. All Smith wanted was a receipt from each entity accepting one of his arrows, a document he used for income tax deduction purposes. The first arrow, with bands of red, blue, and yellow, the Comanche Nation colors, ringing the shaft just below the flange, was installed at Matador in October 2011, next to the old Motley County Jail. A marker placed the arrow points out that one of the Quadahati's favorite campsites had been near here. With the arrows carried in a special trailer, also designed by Smith, the placing of additional arrows continued apace across the 50,000-square-mile region. Descendants of the Parker clan and other Native Americans often took part in dedication ceremonies, offering music and cedar smoke blessings, and educating history buffs and school children alike. The result is one of the nation's largest unique works of public art. Visiting all 88 arrow locations, which range across an area stretching 306 miles from Stratford on the north to Big Spring on the south, would take a while. But the modern-day Western history aficionado can get a good feel for the story this massive project tells by visiting a few key points. To do that, think like the nomadic Comanche people. Archaeologists say that Comanches and other plains tribes seldom camped anywhere for more than 3 days. Otherwise, the hundreds of horses they owned would eat all the grass. The people, as they called themselves, moved from campsite to campsite based on the availability of water, grass, firewood, and the buffalo they needed to survive. Depending on which direction you're coming from, the two best modern-day campsites are Amarillo, which sits astride Interstate 40, the old Route 66, in the upper part of the region, and Lubbock, 120 miles south of Amarillo via Interstate 27. Long before Amarillo began as a rail stop in the late 1880s, the Tascosa Trail cut across the panhandle through future Potter County. On the far northwestern edge of the city, one of the more visually striking of the QPT arrows rises in a place that remains much as it did in Quanah's time. Wildcat Bluff Nature Center, 2301 North Sonsey Road. The arrow is seated dramatically in a stacked stone base. Nearby is a granite marker that reads, "Indians hunting bison for centuries established Tascosa Trail nearby, used by traders and buffalo hunters." Made of gray granite and set nearly flush to the ground, the QPT markers are provided at cost by a monument company in Clarendon, Texas. The concise three lines only text for each marker, a history haiku of sorts, is checked for accuracy and cultural sensitivity by the QPT Steering Committee and other partners, from county officials to historians to the Parker family and the Comanche Nation. Those involved with the QPT effort are quick to point out that they are not attempting to rewrite history, only to offer a balanced perspective on one of the American West's most compelling stories. Back to planning your QPT exploration. After checking out the Guwahati American Indian Museum at 9151 I-40 East in Amarillo, travel 21 miles south of Amarillo on I-27 to Canyon, home to the Panhandle Plains Historical Museum. The museum, Texas's oldest devoted solely to history, has exhibits on the Comanche people. Among the artifacts on display are a headdress, lance, and Winchester rifle that belonged to Quanah. 14 miles east of Canyon, via State Highway 217, is the sprawling Palo Duro Canyon, the nation's second largest canyon. Much of the canyon, which is roughly 120 miles long and averages 6 miles wide, is part of Palo Duro Canyon State Park. The park has a visitor center interpreting the natural and cultural history of the canyon, along with campgrounds, rental cabins, and miles of hiking trails. It was here, in the fall of 1874, that McKenzie and his troopers charged a Guwahati camp on the canyon floor and captured hundreds of the Comanches' horses. From Canyon, head back to Amarillo and rest up around your figurative campfire for a side trip to the site of the 1874 Adobe Walls fight, the confrontation that led to the Red River War, the 1874-75 military campaign that resulted in the final subjugation of the Comanche people. In Borger, the nearest town of any size, check out the Hutchinson County Historical Museum, which has exhibits devoted to Adobe Walls. The arrow sculpture stands adjacent to the museum. Amarillo to Lubbock. Leaving Amarillo for a new base camp in Lubbock, you'll pass through Tulia in Swisher County. An arrow near Tule Canyon marks the place where soldiers slaughtered hundreds of captured Comanche horses. The arrow stands just across from a gray granite marker put up during the Texas Centennial Celebration in 1936. Near the arrow is a new marker noting Quanah Parker never forgot that near this site, September 29, 1874, the U.S. Army shot 1,048 Indian horses. After checking out the Quanah-related exhibit at the Swisher County Archive and Museum, take State Highway 86 east to Kentucky and the 15,300-acre Caprock Canyon State Park. An arrow and marker are near the park, which is home to the state bison herd. In Lubbock, there's an arrow on the grounds of the Fibermax Center of Discovery, 1121 Canyon Drive, commemorating a battle the Comanches had with buffalo hunters in nearby Yellow House Canyon, a once perennial Comanche camping place. The Museum of Texas Tech History, 3301 4th Street, has permanent and rotating exhibits, and while the nationally recognized American Windmill Museum and Ranching Heritage Center are must-sees, they deal with the post-Comanche period of Texas Plains history. Just south of Lubbock is the original arrow, which now has a granite QPT marker explaining Charles Smith's critical role in the trail project. Before he died in 2018, Smith was adopted into the Quanah Parker family and given a Comanche name, Pacahanieta. It means arrow maker. Lubbock to Quanah. From Lubbock, it's 157 miles along US 62 to Quanah. In addition to the exhibits on the chief in the Hardeman County Historical Museum, there's more on him at the nearby Quanah, Acme, and Pacific Depot Museum. A granite monument to the chief stands on the courthouse square. 14 miles southeast of Quanah is the ghost town of Medicine Mound, named for two rounded hills that are still considered sacred Comanche places. The downtown Medicine Mound Museum tells the story. A different approach for your arrow hunt is to follow the Texas Plains Trail, one of 10 regional trails developed by state tourism officials in the 1960s. This blue and white sign marked trail connects 21 communities with notable attractions and heritage sites in the Panhandle and South Plains. A map of the Loop Trail, which moving clockwise from Amarillo, includes Canyon, Claude, Silverton, Turkey, Matador, Crosbyton, Post, Tahoka, Slayton, Lubbock, Leveland, Morton, Muleshoe, Hereford, Vega, Boys Ranch, the site of the old town of Tascosa, Dumas, Fritch, Borger, Panhandle, and then back to Amarillo. All of these communities have QPT arrows or are not far from one. How far you choose to range along the QPT can be measured in miles, but there is a more appropriate metric. As the trail website puts it, more meaningful than the miles Quanah traveled is the distance he covered between the disparate cultures and the transition he made between different ages in the history of the American West. For better or worse, Quanah led his people into the 20th century. Wide spot in the road, Texas. Mobeady, Texas. The only fort the Army garrisoned on the Texas High Plains was Fort Elliott, established in 1875. The presence of the fort in the northeastern corner of the Panhandle fostered the growth of a collection of saloons, brothels, and more conventional businesses that became the town of Mobeady. Nothing remains of the old fort, abandoned in 1890, but a state historical marker stands on the site. At Mobeady, first known as Sweetwater, see the old Mobeady Jail Museum at 300 O'Loughlin Street. Housed in the restored 1896 vintage old Wheeler County Hooskow, the museum has displays on the Red River War, Fort Elliott, and Mobeady's wild and woolly days. Bat Masterson, who went on to greater fame, shot and killed a soldier here in 1876 while he was making a living as a buffalo hunter. The original Fort Elliott flagpole now stands outside the museum, and nearby is one of Charles Smith's giant arrows. WheelerTexas.org. Longtime Texas writer Mike Cox, an elected member of the Texas Institute of Letters, has written more than 35 nonfiction books. He was born in Amarillo in the heart of Quanah Parker's former homeland. Kansas's Santa Fe Trail, True West, April 2022 edition, by Melody Groves. Traversing the Sunflower State from Leavenworth to Dodge City. Timing, as they say, is everything, and that certainly proved true for Missouri trader William Becknell. Once Mexico gained its independence from France in 1821, Mexicans immediately opened the border for trade. Seeing opportunity, Becknell organized a trading party and headed west, unafraid of being jailed like many other traders before him. Becknell left Franklin, Missouri in September 1821 with a small group of men and cargo and arrived in Santa Fe on November 16th. The Santa Fe Trail, first established by Indians and then French traders around 1719 and later fur trappers, was a transportation route that opened the U.S. to foreign trade. Travelers faced dangerous plains, hot, waterless deserts, and steep, perilous mountains. Hot, dry summers gave way to bitterly cold winters. Fresh water was scarce, but the intrepid traders proved invincible. From 1821 until 1846, the Santa Fe Trail was a two-way international commercial highway used by Mexican and American traders, most of the trail lying in Mexican territory. In 1846, when the Mexican-American War began, America's Army of the West followed the Santa Fe Trail to successfully invade Mexico. With the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, New Mexico, and other territories were annexed by the U.S. The Santa Fe Trail became a national road connecting the more settled parts of the United States to the new Southwest territories. Trade reached as far as Mexico City. Commercial freighting along the trail boomed to unimaginable levels, including considerable military freight hauled to supply the southwestern forts. The trail was also used by stagecoach lines. Thousands of gold seekers heading to the California and Colorado gold fields, adventurers, missionaries, wealthy Mexican families, and immigrants. First city of Kansas, Leavenworth. In 1827, Colonel Henry Leavenworth founded the fort named for him on the Missouri River Bluffs. This fort played an important role in keeping the peace among the various Indian tribes and the increasing number of settlers heading west. Founded as Kansas's first city in 1854, Leavenworth became known as the jumping-off point for the opening of the West. Santa Fe Trail travelers often started their adventures from Leavenworth. History still abounds in this historic city. The Fred Harvey House and Museum, currently under restoration, 624 Olive Street, still offers group tours. Be sure to stroll through the historic district on the 5K History Walk, which pinpoints over 130 locations, each building displaying information. The walk starts on Haymarket Square. Offering homemade food in a train station that dates from 1887, the Depot, a national landmark building, serves breakfast and lunch, 781 Shawnee Street. Bailey's Irish Pub, housed in an old remodeled carriage house, offers lunch and supper with food for every taste, 312 North 2nd Street. Ever slept in a converted 1923 high school? Here's your chance. The Leavenworth Local features unique touches and architectural details, 600 Shawnee Street. Lookout, Pawnee Rock. Pawnee Rock, an iconic landmark on the Santa Fe Trail, 16 miles east of Fort Larned, just north of the town of Pawnee Rock, served as a lookout point for American Indians as well as travelers. Traders, soldiers, and immigrants who stopped there carved their names into the brown sandstone, some of which are still visible. Stripping rocks for use as a roadbed in the 1870s, the railroad destroyed about half of this feature. The sandstone citadel marked the halfway point on the Santa Fe Trail and was one of the most prominent landmarks on the long journey. Guardians of the Santa Fe Trail, Fort Larned. Established to protect traffic along the Santa Fe Trail, Camp Alert in 1860 had a small garrison who remained constantly vigilant. Moving upstream to the Pawnee Fork in May 1860, it was renamed Fort Larned. Original sod and adobe structures were replaced with sandstone buildings that make up the fort today. Designated a national landmark in 1961, with nine original buildings still intact, Larned survives as one of the best preserved forts. Fort Larned National Historic Site is open daily with free admission. Last Chance, Council Grove. In 1825, in the scenic East Kansas prairie known as Flint Hills, the Osage tribe and U.S. government agents held a council, giving this settlement its name. With ample water and grass and the last stand of hardwood timber between Missouri and Santa Fe, Council Grove grew into the foremost rendezvous point for thousands of wagon trains traveling the Santa Fe Trail. Travelers who started from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, or Independence, Missouri, would find no more civilizations west of Council Grove until reaching Bent's Fort, 410 miles farther. It was here in Council Grove, the last semblance of civilization, one could buy groceries, oxen, firewood, and replenish water barrels. Rich in tradition, this community retains many historic pioneer sites. Built in 1861, the Terwilliger home was the last house Santa Fe traders passed as they traveled west. Today, it houses the Trail Days Cafe and Museum, known for excellent food in a historic atmosphere. The Hermit's Cave was the temporary home of an eccentric Italian priest, Giovanni Maria Agostini, who lived there in 1863. That fall, he left Council Grove and walked 500 miles on the trail with a wagon train until he left them in Las Vegas, New Mexico. The oldest commercial building in town, built in 1857 and now privately owned, is the Last Chance Store, 502 West Main Street. Located where the trail crossed the Neosho River, it offered final opportunities for freighters to buy supplies before heading west. Take in the scenery along the Neosho Riverwalk, a paved scenic walking and bicycle trail along both sides of the river, from where you'll see the most documented river crossing on the Santa Fe Trail. Eating and sleeping. Known as one of Kansas's finest restaurants, the Hayes House, 1857 restaurant and tavern, was built by Seth Hayes, Daniel Boone's great-grandson. Serving traditional favorites as well as specialties, it is the oldest continuously operated restaurant west of the Mississippi. Following a long day of history exploring, visitors can enjoy the Cottage House, which offers a clean, soft bed. Beginning as a three-room blacksmith shop and cottage in 1867, today it offers 26 rooms and 10 more in an adjacent motel. The oldest remaining home along the Santa Fe Trail is the Bradford B&B Guest House, built in 1860. Prairie Lodge Motel provides charming cabins near downtown. From dugouts to buildings, Fort Dodge. With the Indian Wars heating up in April 1865, the Army constructed Fort Dodge to assist Fort Larned in providing protection on the Santa Fe Trail. The first buildings were sawed in adobe, and most troops lived in dugouts. When lumber arrived in 1866, the first wooden buildings were erected. At its greatest capacity, the fort boasted four companies of infantry. In use for only 17 years, Fort Dodge was deeded to the state of Kansas for use as the Kansas State Soldiers' Home in 1890. When it opened, residents included veterans of the Mexican-American War, Indian campaigns, and both sides from the Civil War. Today, it still serves as a retirement community and nursing facility for Kansas veterans. A museum and self-guided walking tour tells the fort's history. Many of the original buildings are still in use, including the Sutler's Store and Custer's House, in which the famous general never lived but used it as an office. The grounds are open to the public. Get the heck into Dodge. Dodge City. Founded in 1872, 5 miles west of the fort, Dodge City immediately became a trade center for buffalo hunters and travelers. In 1875, Texas Longhorn cattle were driven into town to the new railhead. Cowboys from those drives helped establish Dodge City's reputation as the wildest town on the western frontier. Today, it's much quieter. Vestiges of wilder times do, however, remain. Walk along Front Street and experience Old West reenactments, variety shows, and entertainment during the summer months. Take in the Boot Hill Museum, an accredited Western history museum located on the original site of Boot Hill Cemetery. Stagecoach rides take visitors through downtown. Visit the one-of-a-kind Kansas Teachers Hall of Fame and Gunfighters Wax Museum. 9 miles west of town are tracks of the wagons used by pioneers from 1821 to 1872. The area is listed on the National Register of Historic Sites. Wide spot in the road, Kansas. Cimarron National Grassland. Travelers on the Santa Fe Trail in southwestern Kansas crossed what today is the Cimarron National Grassland. Fed by summer rainstorms and winter snow, this windy 108,175-acre national grassland is administered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Forest Service. The Santa Fe Trail ran across this starkly beautiful area for 23 miles, the largest section on public land, many of the ruts visible today. The Point of Rocks was a landmark on the trail for people heading west on the Cimarron Cutoff. Between the Murphy and Conestoga trailheads, 19 miles of the Santa Fe Trail ruts parallels the trail. Following that route allows today's visitors to experience what life might have been like for the early travelers. Limestone posts help mark the original trail, and interpretive signs explain its history. 8 miles west of Elkhart, Kansas, a good place to begin your visit, is 8 Mile Corner, the tri-state point where the boundaries of three states intersect. Marked with a brass plate and a nearby windmill that has Cans, Okla, and Carlo for blades, it has been in place since 1903. Camping, hiking, fishing, hunting, and horseback riding are allowed at Cimarron National Grassland. Dreaming Nevada, True West, April 2022, by Stuart Rosebrook. Adventures await across the Silver State for the visitor who loves small towns and history. Growing up in Southern California, I spent a great deal of time traveling with my family across the Mojave Desert to Arizona to visit family in Phoenix and tour the Grand Canyon State. I admit I have been to more places in the 48th state than any other, even though California is my home state. But in the last few years, I've discovered a state that I want to explore from end to end and return to on a regular basis, Nevada. That's right, the Silver State, well known for the loneliest highway in America, US 50, the historic Comstock region of Virginia City, and the bright lights of Las Vegas and Reno, all of which are great reasons to visit Nevada. US 50 can be driven in a day between Utah and California, but if you do that, you will miss the chance to visit the historic towns of Ely, Eureka, Austin, and Fallon, let alone the Great Basin National Park and side trips to historic sites and unforgettable ghost towns. My point is, slow down, take your time, and if you can't do it all in one trip, plan on coming back and visiting one or more regions each time you return. And if you love the outdoors, skiing, fishing, hiking, hunting, birding, geocaching, or off-roading, make sure and go prepared because Nevada is an adventure waiting to happen. Driving Nevada. Recently, I completed what I call a circumnavigation of the Silver State, with my only regret being that I did not have a month to do it. Nonetheless, I enjoyed every mile of the road trip, which began and ended crossing the Mike O'Callaghan Pat Tillman Memorial Bridge over the Colorado River at Hoover Dam on the Nevada-Arizona border. I saw hundreds of miles of some of the most beautifully snow-covered peaks, endless desert valleys, lost cell service for 150 miles, and enjoyed the hospitality of small towns and big cities east to west and north to south across the state, and I can't wait to go back. So, where should you start when planning an Old West Heritage trip to Nevada? In many ways, it depends on how you plan to arrive in the Great Basin State, by car or plane, and from which direction. Nevada is served by two major airports in Las Vegas and Reno. One interstate, I-80, across the northern tier of the state. Four historic U.S. highways, 93, 95, 6, and 50. And dozens of state and county roads that travel deep in and out of the hinterlands of Nevada's deserts, valleys, and mountains. And of course, major parts of the state are controlled by the U.S. military and will never be accessible to the public, no matter the route. Your Nevada adventure should be determined first by how many days you have for your vacation, how you will arrive, and if it is a round or through trip. Just know that even a long weekend while enjoying the bright lights of Las Vegas can include a tour of cultural heritage sites, such as the Nevada State Museum and Old Las Vegas Mormon Fort, or in the Lake Tahoe Reno area, Don't miss the Nevada State Railroad Museum and State Museum Carson City. Ely. The first time you arrive in the mountain railroad town of Ely, you will be completely surprised by how beautiful the surrounding mountains are, especially in the winter. US 93 winds up a mountain grade and then drops into the town of Ely, if you are coming from the south via Las Vegas. It is nestled in Steptoe Valley, a basin that extends for nearly 100 miles along the highway in eastern Nevada. Many first-time visitors will schedule a tour of the Northern Nevada Railway Museum and book a ride on the steam or diesel-driven Heritage passenger train. I highly recommend the museum tour, as well as a ticketed ride on the train and attending one of the railroad's specialty events. The historic Hotel Nevada downtown is walking distance from Ely's historic district, but the mountain town also has good choices in national chains. The most difficult choice to make after settling into Ely for a few days is which way to go from there. Head north to I-80 and the crossroads of Wells. Go south on US 6 to Tonopah, a good choice if on a tour of just southern Nevada. Or west on US 50 for a tour of the historic towns along the National Historic Pony Express Trail to the Nevada-California line. For those who are returning to Utah, a right turn out of Ely on US 56 will take you to Baker, Nevada and the Great Basin National Park before crossing a nearly 100-mile stretch of the Great Basin Desert to Delta, Utah. Elko. From Ely, the drive on I-95 to Wells is through some of the least populated areas of the state, and cell service can be very spotty for many miles at a time. Gas up in Ely, as there are a few stops along the way to Wells. Once to I-80, turn west to Elko, with the vast northern deserts of the state to the north and the Humboldt Mountains to the south. Thousands of California 49ers and immigrants followed this route west to California, while an equal number took it back east. Later, hardworking Chinese laborers built the Central Pacific Railroad lines across the unforgiving landscape. Even later, US 40, known as America's Main Street, was the first paved highway across Nevada, following the same basic pathway as the Immigrant Trail and Railroad. Today, the interstate is an easy way to quickly get to Elko, less than 50 minutes, and its heritage-rich community. A side trip on Nevada 230, south to the crossroads of Nevada 229-227, will connect you to 227, to Elko, past the Ruby Mountains, and the quaint village of La Mole. The side trip will add an hour to your drive, but if the weather is good and you have the time, why not? Just gas up and enjoy. In Elko, book a room at a national motel chain or at the historic Star Hotel, which is walking distance from the Railroad City's historic district. First and foremost, don't miss a tour of the Western Folklife Center, J.M. Capriola County Saddle Shop, home of Garcia Bits and Spurs. A short drive from downtown is the Northeastern Nevada Museum, one of the finest heritage sites in the region. You are in beef country, so enjoy a good steak at the Star Hotel Restaurant. Winnemucca. The town of Winnemucca was founded by the Central Pacific Railroad in 1868 at the site of Frenchman's Ford on the Humboldt Trail. Almost 2 hours west of Elko, the route retraces the original routes of the California Trail and the CPRR's section of the first Transcontinental Railroad. The Crossroads City is named after the well-respected local Pote leader, is well known for its annual Ranch Hand Rodeo every March, but is also home to the Humboldt Museum, which has exhibits on archaeology, mining, immigrants, ranching, and the region's indigenous people. While northern Nevada's buckaroo culture is celebrated throughout much of the state, Winnemucca and the high plains of Nevada's deserts and mountain valleys also attracted sheep ranchers and the Basque shepherds from Spain. As one of the nation's centers of Basque culture, Winnemucca hosts an annual Basque festival, which in 2022 will be held June 11th and 12th. From Winnemucca, drive west on I-80 to Reno, Carson City, and the historically rich Comstock region of the state. Or go north on U.S. 95, following the Winnemucca to the Sea Highway to Medford, Oregon, and Crescent City, California. Many immigrants going to Oregon followed this southern route to the fertile farmlands of the Beaver State. The Comstock. After the 1859 discovery of silver in the Comstock, lode became known across the country. Miners poured into the region that would become home to the towns of Virginia City, Gold Hill, Silver City, and Dayton. Not too far away, Genoa, Reno, and the capital city of Carson City began to develop. The region was once just known by fur trappers, 49ers, immigrants, trailblazers, and transcontinental travelers going to and from the Pacific coast and its gold fields. Today, modern-day explorers can immerse themselves in Comstock history and stay at one of the many local hotels, which vary from Lake Tahoe casino resorts to historic inns in Virginia City. Whatever your budget is for overnight accommodations, historic properties, museums, and districts are ready to be explored. Don't miss at least a long weekend in Virginia City and a ride on the Virginia and Kentucky Railroad between the National Historic Landmark and Carson City. When in Dayton, don't miss the Historical Society of Dayton Valley's museum and its great mining exhibits. While in the state's oldest town, Genoa, enjoy a drink at the state's oldest thirst parlor, the Genoa Bar, serving customers since 1853. Tonopah. Anyone who has traveled across southwestern Nevada on U.S. 95 knows that between Las Vegas and Reno, Tonopah is a great place to stop and stay a few days to explore the historic mining region while relaxing at the elegantly restored Mizpah Hotel. Founded in 1907 after silver was discovered and the desert hillsides filled up with eager miners, today Tonopah maintains its western heritage through the Tonopah Historic Mining Park, the Central Nevada Museum, and the historic downtown district. Don't miss a walk through the Pioneer Cemetery. Anchored by the Mizpah and the recently restored Nevada State Bank and Trust Building, now home to the Belvada Hotel. Both hotels were restored by owners Fred and Nancy Klein, who also happened to be the owners of the Tonopah Brewing Company and Klein Wines, which are proudly served at the Mizpah's restaurant. Enjoy a long weekend in the old mining town, relaxing, shopping, and exploring the history of the area. The two local mining museums should not be missed if you have an interest in local history and the boom years of Tonopah's silver and gold mines. Both museums have interior and outdoor displays, but you need to be prepared to hike at the mining park if you want to see all of it on foot. If not, sign up for one of the park's docent-led Polaris-driven tours. After Tonopah, if you are not on your way home, keep the road trip going by heading west on U.S. 95, U.S. 6 to California's Sierra Nevada. Make sure you didn't forget your fishing gear, because the summer trout fishing is spectacular in Mammoth Lakes. Guaranteed, you will be making plans to return to the Silver State, but you'll never forget to bring your camera, binoculars, hiking gear, or your dreams of wide open spaces. Stuart Rosebrook is always ready for a road trip to the great state of Nevada.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.